I'm Don Kerwin, and I'm with the Center for Migration Studies in New York, and also back for a time as executive director of, on an acting basis, at the Catholic Legal Immigration Network. This is the first year that Center for Migration Studies, or CMS, has been a co-sponsor of this particular law and policy conference. However, some of the old-timers in the audience, like me, we'll remember that CMS sponsored the Law and Policy Conference from 1978 to 2003. So we're grateful anyway, and we feel that we've come full circle, that Georgetown and the Migration Policy Institute and Clinic have allowed us to come back into the fold here. The panel that I'm going to moderate is titled Refugee Protection, Territorial Access in the Affirmative Asylum Process. And I think we start with the recognition that our nation's receptivity to the oppressed and persecuted has been a source of national pride and identity since the nation's founding, and a source of pride for our immigration system as well in more recent years. Here's how George Washington put it. How's that for the last session? I'm going to quote George Washington. December 2nd, 1783. The bosom of America is open to receive not only the opulent and respectable stranger, but the oppressed and persecuted of all nations and religions. That was from his address to the members of the Volunteer Association and other inhabitants of the Kingdom of Ireland who have lately arrived in the city of New York. Wouldn't that be great to do talks and have them name things like that? Such a great name. So what we're asking today is, how does the U.S. refugee protection system writ large, including the asylum system and some of the temporary protection programs, how do they look? As part of a project at Migration Policy Institute, I was able to look at the myriad refugee programs and came away, I think, impressed with the generosity of a lot of them, and certainly with the commitment and the expertise of the Asylum Corps and the Refugee Corps and a lot of other people that are involved in this work, but also a little bit concerned over whether the system had kept pace with developments in immigration enforcement, particularly since 1996, and in a national security post 9/11. Certainly these enforcement and security measures have their own rationale and justifications. Many have been successful on their own terms, but it's an open question whether U.S. refugee policies remain as robust as they should be. And I must say that I'm less interested in kind of the debate over whether the U.S. abides by its international commitments in this area, and more concerned, particularly today, over whether we're living up to the spirit of these commitments, particularly on the issue of people's ability, people who are fleeing for their lives, ability to reach our territory. So let me just start very quickly. I won't speak for a long time here, but let me start with the formal refugee resettlement program. We know that it's settled about 3 million people since the fall of Saigon. Refugee admissions fell drastically after 9/11. They rose steadily to about 75,000 a year in 2009, 2010. Then they fell to 56,000 last year, and this year they've begun to shoot up quite dramatically. The issue has been the delays. And there's two types of security reviews, and Barbara's going to talk a little bit about the impact of these. The security advisory opinion and the interagency check, called the one is called the SAO and the other is called the IAC. And these have led to delays in admission of tens of thousands of people, at one point more than 70,000, as I understand it. The SAO review has been applied to certain refugees, including large numbers of Iraqis, based on classified criteria that reportedly haven't changed greatly since 9/11. The IAC applies to all refugees, and it occurs both prior to the refugee interview and to departure. These reviews, combined with time-limited medical examinations and time-limited interviews themselves, have led to cycles of delays, as I said, in tens of thousands of cases. The economic crisis also presented some significant challenges for the refugee program in terms of integration of refugees. This is a program that's premised on early employment, and it's been more difficult, of course, for refugees to get employment and to become self-sustaining. And the kind of proliferation of state laws has now officially found the refugee program, with one state passing legislation that provides for a moratoria on refugee resettlement based on what it calls the lack of absorptive capacity for refugees. That kind of legislation passed in one state. It was introduced in another and passed the committee, but didn't actually pass the full House. And, of course, the governor of Georgia, for those who follow this, called for a resettlement moratorium as well last year. So apart from the refugee program, in recent years, we've seen significantly tightened visa requirements, an expanded expedited removal process, and a more expansive reading and set of terrorism-related grounds of inadmissibility. Whatever the virtues, the merits, or the demerits of these provisions, they certainly make it more difficult for people to reach protection to the United States. I think we can agree on that. On the asylum side, the number of asylum claims granted defensively, that is, in immigration court, fell fairly steadily from 2001 to 2010. And the same is true for the number of affirmative asylum claims. Those are the claims filed before the Department of Homeland Security. We know that the number of asylum claims received in immigration court declined during these same years, but USCIS does not routinely report on the numbers filed and thus the approval rates. I've been particularly surprised by the low number of grants of Mexican asylum cases, I have to tell you, given the horrific violence there. I would have thought it would be more like, the Central American filing in system in the mid-80s or the Haitians in the 90s or something like that, but actually very few of those cases have been granted. However, it seems to me that Mexicans, particularly border residents, are able to flee the violence in other ways. We also know from Andy Schoenholtz's and Phil Schrag's work that legal representation and the judge assigned to a case can matter more in the decision than the strength of the underlying claim even. And we also know from their work that almost a third of affirmative asylum cases have not met the one-year filing requirement, and that requirement is a product of the 1996 Act. I'm particularly pleased with today's panel because it's covering several aspects of the U.S. refugee protection system that I don't know that much about and that at least to me can seem opaque and somewhat inaccessible. And we really have the perfect panel of experts to discuss these issues. Retired Coast Guard Commander Lou Orsini, who's in the middle here, is the Senior Maritime Law Enforcement Advisor at U.S. Coast Guard Headquarters. He has primary responsibility for all international aspects of Coast Guard maritime law enforcement, with a particular emphasis on the Western Hemisphere, although he's going to talk more broadly than the Western Hemisphere. Commander Orsini is going to give us a sense of the difficult conditions in the context of this work and discuss how people who fear persecution or torture are identified on U.S. Coast Guard ships. Barbara Strack, who directs the U.S. Refugee Corps, will then discuss the shipboard credible fear determination process and the subsequent refugee screening process in these cases. She'll also let us know what happens to refugees and people that don't make refugee status at Guantanamo Naval Base. And Commander Orsini and Barbara, I hope, will also give us a sense of the number of people involved in these various stages of the process. Last, but certainly not least, particularly at this conference at Georgetown, and apropos of absolutely nothing that has come before him in this panel, the great Andy Schoenholtz will report on his Georgetown University research team's latest success in making asylum databases ring. He's kind of like the horse whisperer for asylum databases. You know, Andy kind of whispers these things, questions, and they speak back to him. And we've got refugee roulette and all these great studies as the result of that. And in this case, what Andy's going to do is he's going to outline some of the findings from analyzing an immense affirmative asylum data set, or he's going to tell us as much as he can about that work. So the speakers are going to have 7 to 10 minutes each, followed by a few questions from me, and then discussion with you. And thank you for being with us and hanging in here with us till the end of the day. So, Commander Lou.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you very much for inviting me to here. Just by a show of hands, how many of you think you know about the Coast Guard? A handful right now, okay? Let me, and even for those who feel that you know about the Coast Guard, I think you'll probably find a few things in what I'm about to say is things you say, wow, I didn't know that. That the Coast Guard did that. That's because we're kind of a schizophrenic organization. We're multi-mission, we're military, and we're maritime. And we've been around since 1790. We were plank owners in the Department of Treasury and in the Department of Transportation and in the Department of Homeland Security. We are about 45,000 people. We operate roughly 200 ships, roughly 200 aircraft, and about 2,000 boats. We're responsible for patrolling 95,000 nautical miles of coastline, about 3.34 million square miles of exclusive economic zone, and about 6 million square miles of a transit zone from a drug transit zone between South America and the United States. So we're pretty, pretty busy folks. We have 11 statutory missions, of which migrant interdiction is one of those 11 missions. So as you can see, we're kind of spread a lot of different places, and we're doing a lot of different things at the same time. How do we do that? Well, we forward deploy primarily in order to be able to do two things. One is to deter, and the other one is to take action as quickly as possible in order to be able to contain a situation as early as possible in the event of something going on, and to be able to react properly to it and quickly. Essentially, you can break down what we do into three baskets. We protect and prevent people from bad things happening to them on the seas. We protect and prevent the seas from bad things happening to it. And we keep bad things from happening on the water. So when you look at those three things, two of them, migration, kind of fits into two of those three baskets. The U.S. policy is pretty simple. It's to promote safe, legal, and orderly migration. Okay. What's that look like? Well, when you're on the water, it may look a little different than it looks at a border crossing. It may look a little different than it looks at somewhere in work. It may look a little different than it looks at a traffic stop. Let me show you, just to give you an idea of what it may look like when you're out on the water. This is what you might typically come across, something out there, oh, a couple of three, four people on this sailing freighter. Essentially, What we kind of missed going through there was it kept getting more and more people all the time, and the boat that we saw initially with two or three people on it is this one, about 250 people on a 45-foot boat. Now, is that safe? Is that legal? Is that orderly? No, none of those three. So there, as you can see, is what the issues that we're trying to run across. Now, I want to show you a short video here, and this shows you the safety part. And this is in real time, so you can kind of count one, two, three as you go. That is 73 people being rescued and 13 perishing from an overturned sailboat. You saw how quick that went around? About 4 to 5 seconds? That's how quick you can go from a vessel, an overloaded vessel, traveling until they've got 80-some people in the water. It's a scary proposition. That is why we are out there forward deployed.
The pictures you see behind me right now are just photos taken on board Coast Guard cutters. They give you an idea of what it looks like, what some of the things that we do and what we're dealing with. The first thing you need to do anytime you're coming across a vessel, you have to determine jurisdiction. And that determines what's the flag of the vessel. Is it flagged in the United States? Is it flagged somewhere else? Is it not flagged anywhere, which is the most typical situation in any of these law enforcement cases, which gives us automatic jurisdiction. So once we've determined that we have jurisdiction, the next thing is, in an unsafe condition like you've seen there, we go over, we provide life jackets. We bring two small boats alongside, one on each side, because if you went on just one side, people would tend to move to that side. What will happen is just what you saw earlier. Vessel goes turtle, people go in the water. So we come up with two boats, one on each side. We throw life jackets aboard so everybody can have a life jacket. At that point, we start bringing people on board our boats, and one at a time, we bring a boat back, bring people on board the cutter, go back, bring more. And we can do that until we have everybody aboard, safely aboard the cutter. When we bring them on board, the first thing we want to do is to make sure that we have counted for everybody and that nobody's lost and that we know who we have. So So everybody gets a wrist bracelet with a number on it, just like a hospital bracelet you got in the hospital that's on your wrist. And that's simply with a number. So we know if we brought on 88 migrants, and when we take them off, we still have 88 migrants, and we know each one by number. We get a quick medical screening. If there's any minor problems, sickness, illness, injury, whatever, we can treat that on board. We have that capability. If it's something major, we will have to do a medical evacuation. We will actually bring a helicopter out to the ship, assuming it's well offshore, and we'll bring those people to the nearest safe hospital in order to be able to get the treatment that they need. Usually that ends up being in the United States, but it could be in another country as well. It could be in the Bahamas, it could be in Haiti, it could be the Dominican Republic, it could be anywhere. We need to get, depending on what their condition are and what needs to be done. So once you go through that sort of a medical screening and everybody's okay, we've done any treatment that we need to do, then we find a place for them on board the vessel. We provide them with sanitary equipment. We provide them with blankets. We take inventory of their personal effects because we want to make sure that there's nobody's bringing any weapons aboard or anything else that may provide a security risk to our people. And all personal items are inventoried and returned to them when they leave the ship. We keep families together always. They sit together on the cutter. If one of them has to be brought ashore for any reason, they all go ashore. If otherwise, we just make sure we keep them together, and we make sure that all children or adolescents have an adult accompaniment, whether they are a family member or if there's no family member with them, then someone else, another adult, to stay with them. We have Spanish interpreters on board all of our cutters all the time because of where we operate there. We just have that naturally aboard them. When we're operating off of Haiti, we bring aboard a contract Creole interpreter, so we have that interpretation available. We want to be able to talk with the migrants as they come aboard, make sure that everybody's okay, find out any issues, and listen to what they have to say. We are not there to do protection screening. That's not our job. That's the job of CIS, and Barbara will be talking about that shortly. Our job is simply to make sure that everybody's okay and that if there are any concerns expressed by anybody, that we call in CIS. If nobody expresses a concern, then we don't need to call in CIS for interviews. Now, there are actually three different U.S. policies out there. There is a Cuban policy. In a Cuban policy, every Cuban migrant that we interdict gets a CIS interview, unless they refuse it. That everyone. We have Chinese policy. Every Chinese interdicted gets a written, in their language, a questionnaire that they fill out, which we turn over to CIS. That's to indicate so CIS can read through the questionnaire and make a determination whether or not they need an interview. If so, we arrange an interview. For anybody other than Cubans and Chinese, there's not an automatic interview. There's only an interview done by CIS if we call them in, and we call them in if there are any indications of fear of return. So that's that's how we work that piece of it. Then you get to the disposition piece. And with disposition, it's determined in a couple of different ways. We have agreements with some countries that allow us to do disposition through notification through the Department of State and the embassy, and we make arrangements and we bring them back and repatriate them. Anytime we do a repatriation, you're going to see someone from the U.S. embassy will be there at the pier meeting us, as well as the host, as the officials from the nation from which we're going into. And if there are any available, any NGOs such as Red Cross or others, that are there and are interested, they may also be at the pier to meet us. We make sure that we have accountability coming off the cutter, just as we did coming on. The same number come off as come on, and everybody got their stuff back that they needed, and we have folks there that speak their language, both on our end, on the other end, and then our part is done at that point, and then we go back out on patrol. I think I will leave it.
Can I just ask you a quick question?
Sure.
So that this issue of people expressing concern is that's the trigger to call CIS, but is that they have to come forward affirmatively to do that? And what kind of concerns would they have to express for CIS to be called?
Mm-hmm. Any indication of any fear of return to their country. Now that can be a thing such as the person says, I'm afraid to go back. I fear for my life, I fear for my family's life, I fear for whatever I fear for, a verbal expression. It could be something physical. It could be someone cowering in a corner. It could be somebody that's showing unusual injuries, a broken arm that's unexplained, burns on their body that would not be of the norm. Anything that we see that indicates any doubt in our mind that person would have a fear of return, that is when we call CIS. As I said, we're not experts in that regard. We don't claim to be expert or pretend to be experts. We simply, if something comes up, we call them. If nothing comes up, then we repatriate through the normal channels. And like I said, the exceptions being for the Cubans who all get a interview regardless.
Sometimes it's reported in some of the human rights reports as kind of the shout test. You know, somebody's on board the ship and they have to shout to get your attention. Is that the way it works or not?
No, it doesn't really. I mean, that certainly is one way you could get our attention if you shouted, but that's sort of a misnomer. That's an indication that somebody would have to firmly come forward and say, I have a fear. That's one way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And we purposely have people who can speak the language, whether they're our own crew or a contract interpreter, so that if there's any questions, they have somebody they can talk to. That person has identified him or herself and says, here's who I am, here's what I'm doing. So anybody wants to talk to me, you can. We do not affirmatively go out and ask everybody to say, do you have a fear of return? We don't do that. But we do have people available. We are watching. We are looking for indications that somebody may have a concern or a fear of return. And if they do, that's when we call in CIS. If we see none of that, then we don't.
Do you get trained on looking for those?
Don, if I could jump in on
ahead,
that, so I'm
please.
Sorry to interrupt. One of, I mean, traditionally there has been training, but this is one of the areas both Coast Guard and USCIS had identified that we thought we could be doing better and we could be doing more. And so we're working on the final stages now of a video on training on exactly this issue, which will have examples of both verbal and physical manifestations of fear. We used to do in-person training, but we realized that with the pervasiveness of the video technology nowadays, so every cutter that is rotating through the Caribbean theater basically will have this, and so the frontline officers, you don't call them officers, I apologize.
No, officers.
So the frontline staff, everyone will have the opportunity to see it on kind of a continuous loop. So we think that's a big improvement over the training, which used to be delivered in person. Train the trainer. There could be an attenuation of time between the time you received your training, the time you were there. So we think that'll be a big improvement, and it definitely emphasizes. The term of art we use is the manifestation of fear, so it includes both verbal and nonverbal.
Can I just ask a quick question of Lou? So is there any reason, though, that the Coast Guard doesn't do what Customs and Border Protection does in the expedited removal context at the land or seaport of entry or airport of entry, which is to simply ask the four questions, or I'll take one question, is there a fear, do you have any fear of returning, of all the migrants?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason that the Coast Guard doesn't do that?
It's not part of our policy to do so. That's not one of the things we do. And even if we ask that question, what would we know?
You would know that somebody's either expressed a fear or didn't. So the same thing you'd know that the Customs and Border Protection would know, and therefore they then know when to refer to CIS.
Here's the difference between CBP at the border and Coast Guard at sea, which is really what the question you're trying
right.
you're getting at.
Right.
When you're at the border, you're at land. If I ask everybody what if they have a fear of return, somebody says yes. I can put them in a place. I have an easy place to put them. If I'm at sea and I ask everybody, I ask 150 people, you saw them, 150, 250 people, and every one of them says, yeah, I do. I have a fear of return. That now, we are now loaded up on deck. We have no place to put them except for on deck. That cutter is out of commission. I can't do any more patrolling. I can't do anything else except for wait for CIS to come out, conduct 250 interviews of people because they said I have a fear of return because I asked them. And if I ask you if you have a fear of return, the chances of getting a yes are probably much greater than the chances of getting a no, simply because it won't take them long to figure out that every time they say yes, everybody gets an interview. Every time you say everybody gets an interview, you have a whole bunch of operational units that are tied up. At some point, you actually run out of cutters that can even do the job because it doesn't take a lot of those to come to all stop for operations for us. So it's a, and I'll say one other thing is the INA doesn't apply at sea, where INA does apply when you get on the land border. So we're in some different rules at that from that standpoint.
Certainly with respect to the INA. With respect to the Refugee Convention, even though our Supreme Court has said it doesn't apply in the high seas, there's no other Supreme Court in the world that has said that. And the Australians and the Europeans operate under the assumption that the Refugee Convention applies on the high seas. So they screen everybody who they interdict on the high seas.
This is the cases, the Sale versus the Haitian Centers Council case, which basically in 1993 shocked a number of us, the Supreme Court. I think it was a unanimous decision.
No, 8-1.
8-1. Article.
What a shock.
It was to me.
Well, no, I mean, it was likely that the... I'm sorry, I don't mean to...
Yeah, that's okay. what it basically held is that the withholding of deportation standard in Article 33 of the Refugee Convention didn't apply on the high seas. And so the Coast Guard could do this and return people. And so it kind of turned what we thought was a legal duty into kind of a humanitarian responsibility is what it did.
And you know, in fairness across the board, it's the Supreme Court of the United States who's determines what we do, not
absolutely.
Not what the Europeans do, not what any other country in the world does. It's what our courts call. So I was done. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So thank you. A quick question on the repatriation. Maybe Barbara, you're the one that's going to talk about this. So you're returning people to Haiti, but are you returning them anywhere else? You talked about the disposition of the cases.
We return people to where the primary ones we have are Cuba,
right.
Haiti, and the Dominican Republic, because mm-hmm. that's where most of the flow of maritime illegal migration is occurring at. But we also get mixed bags. We'll get a group of Brazilians and Sri Lankans and Indians and Ethiopians and something else, and they end up because we're not able to bring them back to Sri Lanka or India or somewhere else. It's impractical from a standpoint. They come into the United States for expedited removal.
Mm-hmm.
But for those that are interdicted who are in the region, they get repatriated to the country from which they came.
Mm-hmm.
Usually one of the three I just named.
Okay. So Barbara, you. Somebody expresses or manifests a fear of persecution or torture, and then you all get called, and then how does it work from there?
Sure.
Yep.
My presentation will be kind of bifurcated. Part of it is talking about the protection screening for interdicted migrants, and then the second part will be talking about the bulk of the work we do, which is actually the traditional refugee resettlement program that Don referred to in his opening. So this slide, I'm not sure how legible it is, depicts USCIS's part of the credible fear screening process that Lou described. And as we said, any interdicted migrant, regardless of nationality, who manifests a fear is given an opportunity to speak with a specially trained USCIS officer. Although there are different triggers on the front end, as Lou described, the screening itself, once USCIS is involved, is the same. So we send specially trained officers to do protection screening interviews
on the migrant on cutters at sea to determine if the applicants have a credible fear of persecution or torture. In order to do this, we have an officer who's stationed virtually 100% of the time at Key West, so they are in operational communication with Coast Guard in Sector Key West every day, so they're available to go out to the cutters when they're needed, and they stay as long as necessary in order to do the interviews for the migrants on board. All of those officer assessments are sent back to someone at headquarters, so we have essentially 100% supervisory review of those, and that's really where the final determination is made. On some occasions, if we need more information, we can either call the officer or send the officer out again to do a second interview. For obvious reasons, we try to minimize that, but the important thing is that we have the factual record that we need. In most cases, we can make a decision based on that. There are times when we find we need some additional information, so we may want to do some research. If someone tells us they had a previous immigration benefit, if they tell us they visited our USCIS office in Havana, we may need to do a little bit of research. But in most instances, we can make that protection decision once the information is sent to headquarters. What this slide describes is for migrants who are found not to have a credible fear if they're returned to their country of they are returned to their country of origin, as Lou just described. Those who are found to have a credible fear are transferred by the Coast Guard to the naval station at Guantanamo Bay. Perhaps it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, it is a completely separate operation in every way from the detainee operation, both physically, legally, every other way. Once a migrant goes to Guantanamo, there's a little bit of an onboarding process, but then there's the place where they have their second full-blown refugee interview to determine whether they have a well-founded fear. So the first one, credible fear, is the relatively low standard just to make a first screening determination. The second one is a full-blown refugee interview. And those are also reviewed at USCIS headquarters in terms of the final disposition. For migrants at Guantanamo who are found not to have protection concerns under the well-founded fear standard, they are also repatriated to Cuba. It is a land repatriation. They go through what is the northeast gate from the naval station into back to Cuba proper. For those who do have a protection concern, they are transferred to the care and custody of the State Department. And the State Department has contractors at what's called the Migrant Operations Center at the Guantanamo Naval Base, and they're responsible for the care and custody of the protected migrants. They're also responsible for finding a third country who will accept the resettlement of those migrants. This goes back to what Lou talked about in his presentation. The premise of the program is to promote safe, legal, orderly migration and not to encourage illegal, irregular, inherently dangerous maritime migration. And so the decision has been that it's important to break that connection from a maritime departure to coming to the United States. To give you just a couple of statistics, in fiscal year 12, there were nearly 1,200 migrants who were interviewed at sea by USCIS. Only about 3.6% were found to have credible fear. We think that an important way in terms of understanding that credible fear goes back to the disposition of migrants who go to Guantanamo. We believe that a lot of migrants do not want to go to Guantanamo and do not want third country resettlement. Their goal is to come to the United States. And so we believe that many migrants don't even try to make the showing of credible fear because the path that puts you on is well known and it's not the path that they want to be on. Out of those migrants who do go to Guantanamo, who make the credible fear threshold, there are also some direct arrivals at Guantanamo. In addition to the interdicted migrants, there are some migrants who either make it through to the Guantanamo Naval Base by land or who swim. Of those, 65% have been found to have well-founded fear in FY12. Those numbers are relatively stable over time. So that's where I was going to wind up on the interdiction process and move to the regular refugee resettlement. Don, do you want to ask any questions now or go forward?
Yeah, could you go through the 65%? What is that again?
The 65% is of those migrants who go to Guantanamo, 65% have been, in last fiscal year, were determined to have well-founded fear and were put on a path for third country resettlement.
I see. And is there a particular issue with Cubans that kind of not giving refugee claims or not kind of claim because they particularly want to go to the United States? Is there some?
I don't know that I can answer that. I mean, we overwhelmingly interview Cubans, and right. so the rate that I've given you in terms of credible fear is essentially a Cuban rate.
I see.
So I don't think we have enough experience to extrapolate on other nationalities.
Mm-hmm.
Let me turn now to our the lion's share of the work we do in the Refugee Affairs Division at USCIS. This is really sort of our mission statement, to offer resettlement opportunities to persons overseas who are of special humanitarian concern while protecting national security and combating fraud. The acronym at the top is U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. It is a shared responsibility of DHS and the State Department, PRM, Population, Refugees, and Migration. It really is a dual mission, and although many people think of that as contradictory missions, we really think of it as very much complementary, because we think in order to maintain a robust refugee resettlement program, safeguarding the integrity of that program mm-hmm. is critical. And I would describe it as critical for three different reasons. I mean, one is for the program itself. We are fortunate that the refugee resettlement program has a longstanding tradition of support. It's bipartisan. We want to make sure, as stewards of that program, we don't undermine that support by not keeping our eye on the integrity of the program. Obviously, we want to prevent the program being used to bring anyone to the United States who would do harm. But we also think that integrity is important in terms of protection, because resettlement slots worldwide are a very, very scarce resource. And so we think it's very important to do what we can to make sure that those resources go to the individuals for whom they're intended and they're a protection tool for real refugees. And also from the refugee perspective, we think that integrity is important because having safeguards in place helps protect refugees themselves from possible pressure and exploitation in order to perhaps manufacture family relationships that aren't real family relationships or to substitute people in their family. So if we're doing our job, refugees can't be pressured that way because we'll have safeguards in place that would prevent those kinds of manipulations. You know, we saw that we think this integrity piece is very important. Some of you may know that a year ago, two Iraqi refugees were arrested in Kentucky on terrorism charges. For anyone who's worked in an immigration program, you know it's a bad day when your program is the engine that allows bad actors or criminals to come to the United States. We did literally dozens of Hill briefings in the wake of those arrests, with the State Department, with our vetting partners, with our law enforcement colleagues from DHS, to be able to tell them about how we vet refugees, what had changed since the time these refugees had been admitted, how we've been able to enhance them. And we think being able to have those conversations side by side with the intelligence community, with the vetting partners, was critical to allowing the program to continue at the pace that it was. We did not have the kind of backlash that happened after 9/11 when the refugee program was decimated. And we really think it was because we were minding the store on the integrity all along, and those safeguards were already in place, so we were already able to talk about what we had done. This slide may be difficult to see, I realize. It's basically numbers showing a sort of a five-year time sequence in terms of what the refugee admission ceiling has been, how many applicants we have interviewed, and how many have been admitted. To really cut to the chase on this, the highlights are that in FY09 and FY10, those were our good years. We approached the presidential ceiling very closely, and we had a very even flow throughout the fiscal year, which is very important to the quality of resettlement and helps the domestic resettlement agencies do their best work. It fell short of the ceiling in both FY11 and FY12, which was largely but not 100% due to some of the security check issues that, that Don alluded to. The good news that I can share today is that we are, to a certain extent, over the hump in terms of some of those challenges of security checks. And starting in May of this year, we started having dramatic increases again in refugee admissions. We had a very, very strong fourth quarter in terms of refugee admissions. We don't have the final figure for refugee admissions. It takes a little while for sort of everyone whose airplane landed yesterday for all that data to get wrapped up, but we're expecting we're probably going to break 58,000. So it's not a great number. It's not a number we're satisfied with, but it shows growth over last year. We're also very well poised for FY13. The ceiling for this coming year is 70,000, which is a little more modest than in the recent past, but the thinking this year was it's a building year. It's a year to say, here's the ceiling, and we're going to say what we're going to do and do what we say, as opposed to having these years where we've had a shortfall. So the State Department tried to be very realistic, taking overseas capacity and domestic capacity into account. To talk about how we did it, so how did what went wrong and how we fixed it this fiscal year, it really was the four key steps that are on the slide in terms of those little check marks. The single most important thing, I would say, was what we call the interagency checks that Don alluded to. These were new checks that were introduced as an enhancement to the refugee program. We thought they were very, very important, but it took some time on an interagency basis to make sure that they were calibrated correctly and that we had the right framework for interpreting those results. So that's what happened through a lot of interagency work and very important role by the National Security Staff, including the Deputies Committee. So we got a framework in terms of how to look at those checks, and once we had that framework, we were able to start implementing. So we started implementing the new framework in March. We started to see the results in May and going forward. The SAOs, the security advisory opinions, are another kind of check that are performed on refugees, and there have also been backlogs in that check, which is administered largely by the State Department. But there's a lot of interagency work that has gone on in that regard as well, particularly the check mark number two there, the harmonized validity periods for security checks. Pretty much every security check has a validity period, and if a person doesn't travel, if a refugee doesn't travel in that window, you have to run the check again. There are fingerprint checks, there are biographic checks, there are medical exams, there are all kinds of things. And the challenge was if you had a family of four and one person had one of those checks get stuck, by the time that check came through, everything else for everyone else in the family might have expired and you started all over again. And it was a very small window. So we were able to work together to harmonize. So a lot of the starting times start together, end together, and it maximizes the window for refugees who are approved to otherwise get on airplanes. So that's made a really big difference. We also looked at things that we could do, and the State Department looked at things it could do just administratively. Where were the things, and I heard Ali Mayorkas talk about this earlier today, where are the places where some of our own policies weren't making sense? They weren't giving us a benefit for the buck, but they were having a detriment. And one of them was we had a policy just like fingerprints or security checks expire. As a policy matter, we had decided that our interviews expired after 1 year. And after a year, we wanted to talk to the person again to see had they committed a crime, had they gone back to their country of origin, certain other things. So we were spending time doing re-interviews. And after doing them for a while, we ended up realizing that they weren't developing new significant information in a lot of cases. So we were making a lot of effort, but it wasn't being very productive. So we decided instead of a routine re-interview policy, we could have a routine policy based on triggers. That means it's been great for, or it's been so helpful for refugees in Syria because we can't get back to Syria to do re-interviews. So if there's a particular case that we need to re-interview, we will make that happen. But otherwise, we can have a lot of cases not need to be re-interviewed, and that means that time we used to spend doing re-interviews, we can spend doing new cases for new applicants. Another thing we did, again, was the electronic resubmission of fingerprints. This, again, sounds really technical and probably like a no-brainer, but it's hard logistically. Again, there's a general rule of applicability that fingerprints are good for 15 months. We were having to go back and recollect the fingerprints to resubmit them. And we worked with U.S. Visit and other partners that we can resubmit the prints electronically. And that's also helped a lot. So there are other efficiencies that we're still looking at in terms of the all steps of the process. But I think what you've seen in terms of the uptick in admissions really reflects a tremendous amount of work on an interagency basis. And let me just close with this slide of the world. This shows a pretty typical pattern for our recent years, that in FY12, we worked in 64 different countries. Again, this is actually the countries where we work. It's not the nationalities of the applicants. So, for example, you won't see Somalia on this slide because we don't work there, but we interview Somalis in Kenya and many other locations. The way we're able to do this is a combination. The backbone of the program is the Refugee Corps. That's part of my office, officers who are based in Washington and who fan out around the world to interview refugee applicants face-to-face. But we also have colleagues from USCIS who are based in embassies overseas, and so they do some of the refugee work. We're also very fortunate that we can borrow some staff from other parts of USCIS. So we get people who go out maybe once a year or every other year with us, and they're well-trained. They're asylum officers. They're lawyers. There's others who know protection law and get extra screening in order to do the refugee work. In terms of what's coming up in FY13, the program still will remain the three largest nationalities, Iraqis, Bhutanese, and Burmese. That's been the case for a number of years now. In terms of changes coming on board, we expect for the coming year and going into FY14, we're going to see some larger admissions from Africa that already rebounded a little bit this year. But PRM has worked with UNHCR, and we're going to see a lot more referrals of Congolese refugees from a variety of countries. And also, some of you may be familiar with the Priority 3 program, which is the family-based prong of refugee processing. It was shut down in 2008 due to fraud concerns. It's starting again. PRM has announced the official start on October 15th, and that tends to skew towards the African nationalities as well. So certainly many challenges remain for us. Physical access to refugees is a big challenge. I mentioned we can't get to Syria. We haven't had officers in Syria since March of 2011. We can't go to Dadaab camp because of the security there. The safety and security of our officers is a big challenge all the time, but we work very closely with the State Department and in some instances with UNHCR. So sometimes if we can't get to the refugees, we work to try to see if the refugees might be able to get to a different place. So we use the emergency transit centers in Europe. There's some other small plans to move groups of refugees, for example, from Dadaab camp to Kakuma. So we work very hard on a partnership basis to try to get our access to them. Just in closing, Don mentioned TRIG, terrorism-related inadmissibility grounds. We used to call it material support, but it's a little broader than that. It's an area overall that has been a challenge, I guess, to say at a minimum. The agency, USCIS agency-wide, has exercised its exemption authority over 14,000 times. And of those 14,000 agency-wide, over 11,000 of them have been in the refugee program. In particular, it has been Burmese groups, where there's been voluntary association with some of the Burmese groups, and it's been very important in the Iraqi program with respect to duress, so particularly cases that involved payment of ransom or for kidnapped family members or threatened kidnap. So those are the two places where the TRIG exemption authority has worked and is working for the refugee program, albeit it's been slower than I think any of us would have wished, and we have more work to do.
Barbara, could I ask just a couple clarifying questions?
Sure.
When people are approved in Guantanamo for refugee status, they're resettled to a third country, is that right?
Yes.
Where do they go?
The State Department works with other countries to find countries that are willing to take them. So it's quite a variety of countries. Sometimes Canada, it's been Spain, I think Hungary. So it's a variety of countries.
And not brought to the U.S., never brought to the U.S.?
Generally not, unless, of course, there are some exceptions. In a medical case, for example, mm-hmm. there's a good hospital at Guantanamo, but if a migrant has a condition that can't be treated there, they would be brought in. There are some circumstances, for example, if there were an unaccompanied minor with family members in the United States, they might be brought in, but those are very exceptional cases.
And this ability to kind of harmonize the various checks and interviews and biometrics and all those things, what happens to linked cases? Are linked cases affected, for example, if you have a distant relationship to kind of somebody that is tripped by a security clearance, do they then get stuck as well?
That's a little bit of a mixed bag. It depends on how closely related the cases are. So in some cases, for example, if you imagine a younger family and, say, elderly grandparents. It may be that those elderly grandparents could not support themselves and wouldn't want to travel to the U.S. So if, say, the father of the younger family was stuck, the elderly parents would be considered a cross-reference, and those would be handled together. In other instances, PRM and the resettlement support centers use what they call a soft cross-reference. And so let's say there are some adult siblings. They might ordinarily prefer to travel together, but the nature of the security check, if someone gets stuck, the other family members could decide that they were willing to go ahead and travel without. We wouldn't separate a nuclear family. You don't separate the people on the same case,
right.
But sometimes these more attenuated connections, we use the term soft cross-reference, the family can elect to travel separately.
Okay. And I just was amazed, I must say, at the kind of productivity of the Refugee Corps. I mean, as I think I looked at some of the numbers, and you're doing more than 100,000 interviews per year now, I mean, with a fairly small group of people. So I wanted to just acknowledge that.
Thank you. We've backed off slightly from the 100,000,
yeah.
But we are a productive group. We work really hard. A typical quarter of the fiscal year will have 100 officers out at a time, working in nowadays typically 12 to 15 locations.
Thank you.
So, Don, thanks for inviting me to participate in the PowerPoint panel. Unfortunately, I brought my PowerPoint along, and Lisa knows how to use it. So, first, I just want to say that I am delighted that you've all stayed around this long. It's been a long but a great day. We've had wonderful panels, and thanks for lasting it out. And I hope we have a little time for some questions. I'll try to be quick in the 10 minutes I have. I've been very fortunate to work with two great researchers on a major project regarding how to understand how our laws, how our asylum laws are actually implemented. And I've had great cooperation from the federal government in doing so. My colleagues Phil Schrag and Jay Ramji Nogales and I published in 2009 a book called Refugee Roulette, which looked at disparities in asylum adjudications at all four levels of asylum decision-making, the asylum office, immigration courts, the BIA, and then the federal courts. The new study we're doing, which is called Lives in the Balance, only looks at the DHS asylum officer decision-making. Okay, that's it. It's looking in much greater detail. But remember that 80% of all asylum applications are affirmative applications. That's what the data we have shows. I won't have time to go deep into the study at all. This is definitely just touching, to give you a sense of, touching the surface of it, just to give you a sense of what kind of questions can you ask with the data that the government has. And I'll briefly describe the database, talk a little bit about the one-year deadline, and then look at some interesting ways to understand merits decision-making. So the database itself, the database has more than 380,000 cases. It starts in October 1st, 1995 and goes through June of 2009. We only were looking at the we have two other databases as well, I should say. The merits database is a subset of the full one and has 329,000 decisions, still very large. And then we also were fortunate to have some asylum officer biographical data from about 31,000 cases based on forms that the asylum officers filled out at FLETC when they were doing training. And this allows us to do some, you know, some learning about the same thing we tried to do with regards to immigration judges in Refugee Roulette, where we have biographical data. What sort of demographic characteristics, for example, result, or at least are associated with, correlate, as we say, with certain outcomes in the decision-making process. So I'm just going to go through a few slides to give you a taste of what this is like. I don't think you'll see surprises in a couple of these. This just tells you in the large database where people come from, and it's divided into four eras before the deadline was initiated, you know, in mid-1998. Then we took the 9/11 event as another divider.
And then we took the implementation of Real ID, and I mean the implementation, not when it was passed, but when asylum officers were trained on Real ID, and therefore we might be able to see, is there any effect? Is there any difference in terms of the outcomes of the cases in that situation? And the thing that you see here is that Latin America was the principal source of applicants during this period, followed by sub-Saharan Africa and East Asia, which is principally China, of course, largely invited by Congress. You can also see that East Asian applications skyrocket after 1998, and the application rates have dropped significantly in the last few years, with the principal declines coming from Latin America and Africa. We also had some information from the applicants themselves on their asylum applications, and not all of them did provide anything about religion, but 77% did, and so we recorded that, and we're a little careful about how we use this, but this is the basic information about what they said about their religions, and I assume it's no surprise to you that the vast, vast majority of our asylum applicants, at least since 1995, have been Christian. The one-year deadline. We've already published in the William & Mary Law Review in 2010 the results of our one-year deadline study, and there are over 50 graphs there, so I'll only show you two today. And basically, the first thing we looked at is, okay, what can we learn about who's late in filing? That is, who's determined to be just late? Not whether or not they've met an exception yet, just whether or not they're late in filing. And here's the interesting thing we found, is that it really does differ among nationalities quite considerably. So we have the Indonesians filing at a late 45% of the time, whereas the Armenians are filing late only 15% of the time. And we doubt that Congress actually enacted the deadline thinking that it would favor certain nationalities and disfavor others, but that seems to be the result, and that means that the deadline is, which is a non-merits factor, right? It's not about the merits of the asylum claim, it's about the protection claim. It's a non-merits factor, has a strong influence in the outcomes of these cases, and we did an analysis to try to estimate how many asylees were not recognized because of the deadline over this 14-year period, and it turns out to be about 21,000 people, so it's not insignificant. The other interesting issue to look at, just in brief, is the rejection rates by nationality. So here, too, where there are two statutory exceptions to filing late. You can file late, but if you meet one of the two exceptions, you can then go and have your merits claim listened to and decided upon. You may be granted asylum, you may not, but you can at least have it heard. The rejection rates vary considerably among the nationalities. So fewer than 20% of the late Iraqis and Liberians were actually rejected because of the deadline, compared with more than 75% of Guatemalans, Ivorians, Gambians, and Mauritanians. We don't really know why, but that's how the deadline is implemented. And our concern has always been, if it's implemented in an unfair way, in the sense that Congress certainly didn't intend it to, it raises questions as to why it exists. And we certainly know that it has resulted in at least asylum seekers who otherwise qualify for asylum not getting asylum itself. They may have qualified for withholding of protection or CAT protection in immigration court, but we don't know that because we have yet to get the two agencies who have all that data to bring it together so it can be analyzed. But that will happen at some time, I'm sure. So let's look at some of the issues that we did look at in this new study, and this now is all about the decisions made on the merits, not about deadline cases. Only cases where there was a decision on the merits, and I'll just show you one sample of the kind of case that we looked at, but you can imagine that there's lots of ways you can do this sort of analysis. And the reason I can't show you a lot is, number one, time, but also we're doing our final regression analyses, so we have to make sure everything is perfect before we go public with this. And ultimately, this will all be public and on a Georgetown website, so you'll be able to see in great detail and all the outcomes we have. So one of the things we wanted to look at was, okay, does the human rights situation in a country correlate with higher or lower grant rates? So I think we'd all expect for people coming from a more abusive country that there would probably be higher grant rates from the asylum office because of that. So you can, if you can see, the red bars are represent the grant rates for the more abusive countries, again broken down by these four asylum eras that we defined. And the good news from our point of view, and I think this is complementary to the asylum office, is that during every period of time here, the grant rates are higher for people coming from the most abusive countries, which is what we would expect if it were working according to the basic law, right? So that's good news. The only thing that's somewhat troublesome here is if you look at the third and the fourth sets of bars here, you'll see that the rates fell after 9/11 much more significantly for the most abusive, for people coming from the most abusive countries rather than less abusive countries, and we don't, well, we're not sure why, but ask yourself why that might be. Okay, another way to get into the data that we have from the Department of Homeland Security is look at the characteristics of the applicant. And there's a lot that we're doing with that. There's gender issues. There's a variety of issues that we can look at based on who they are. There's age. Did they come with dependents? All sorts of things. I'll just show you one example. And this has to do with whether or not an applicant is represented, a theme that Don has brought up earlier. Now, in the asylum office context, representation is not quite as outcome determinative, if you will, as it is in the immigration judge context, and we can talk later perhaps about why that is. Yet, at the same time, it's clear that representation makes a difference at the asylum office as well. Those without representatives in our database, won asylum, that is those pro se, won asylum 32% of the time overall, while represented applicants won 43% of the time. And it does seem, though, that representation, if you can look at the third and fourth sets of bars, is not correlating with that big a difference anymore with those who are pro se. So that's a fascinating question to investigate. Why would that have changed? What's going on? It might say something about the asylum officers. It might, for all we know, their asylum, we just don't know. There's lots of things that could be said, both positive and then that raise questions. So we're trying, in effect, to get a discussion going on those sorts of issues. Now, something you saw earlier from Refugee Roulette, we also did, but with a larger database here, so we wanted to come circle back and see how this was. And I'll just give you two examples. Looking at the eight regional asylum offices and disparities within those offices, only comparing the offices, in and of themselves. And the bars that you see on the next two graphs indicate asylum officers, their grant rates, their overall grant rates, this one in Chicago, where they decided made at least 100 decisions. Okay, so they've had enough decisions. Probably all these asylum officers had the same more or less sample of cases that anybody else in the asylum office had because these are distributed randomly to the asylum officers. There's no specialization of country per se. And you can see in Chicago that the grant rates range from 18 to 62%. And here is a graph of Newark. Many more officers in Newark. In Chicago, it was 55 officers. The office mean, the average grant rate was 37%. In Newark, there were 80 officers who made at least 100 decisions in our database. The average grant rate was not too dissimilar, 32.5%. But the grant rates ranged even further from 2.5% to 92.5%. So that's quite a range. And that's not too different from some things we saw before in the earlier study. The last type of information that we've looked at are officer characteristics, and in some ways this is the most interesting, and I'll only have time to show you one at this point, but you can ask yourself a variety of ways to think about this, and one of the things we will hopefully be able to talk about ultimately will be asylum officer education. In fact, at a law school, this might be fairly meaningful. Did the asylum officers have law degrees? And did that result in different outcomes in terms of the grant rates? I'm not answering that today. Today, I'm only looking at the officers' experience, and that is what happened in their grant rates as they made more decisions, right? So here we have five different divisions here. The decisions 1 through 250, decisions 251 to 500, et cetera. It's broken down by every 250 decisions. And what's interesting about this is that in contrast with what probably most people think and assume, that asylum officers get jaded as they make decisions, it certainly seems that the grant rates have generally gone up. So that's the sort of information that we can get at. I'm not going to give you examples of what more you could find, but when the study comes out, it will be, again, on our website, and there will be a book. But I just want to say two things in closing, if I may. First is that the reason we can do this type of analysis is that the USCIS Asylum Office is really interested in learning about how they are implementing the law. That, to me, is really incredibly important. And it's not just that we have a good working relationship with some really excellent professionals. They truly care about what they're doing, and they want to know what they're doing. And it would be great if our government had resources to do this internally and externally, but the bottom line is, you know, we've sort of volunteered to do some of this, and it's a great group of people to work with because they are really want to know what's going on. They've been exemplary in this way, and we've learned a lot, not simply by doing the quantitative analysis, but we go around and talk to a lot of people in the asylum offices, I should say, and also practitioners around the country and advocacy groups, and to try to understand what this data means. I mean, why are the outcomes as they are? Everybody's got their hypotheses, but you're more informed if you talk to people who are doing this on a daily basis, and they have some ideas as well. So the bottom line is what we're trying to do is identify any problems in decision-making and find ways to address them, and we will have some recommendations to make. And hopefully that this book, too, will create some sort of conversation, just as I think Refugee Roulette did, about that. But we're also here to find out what's working well, and that will be part of this study as well.
Thank you very much. So we have time for just a few questions here. As we wait for questions, let me just ask the panel if there's any kind of policy recommendations or improvements that they want to recommend, ideas that they have. You're welcome to do that, or closing statements, things that you want to say.
My name is Danielle Beach Oswald, and I'm an ALA immigration attorney. I have actually two questions. One relates to TRIG. Do you have any statistics, either any of you that would address this, that show how long some of these cases are pending? Because we know that sometimes these cases are pending since 2003, and they just tell us they're at headquarters, and they've been granted asylum, but nothing happens. And family members are blocked. And sometimes the principal's been granted, and the family members, the derivative's been granted, but the principal has not, which is very strange also. And then my second question relates to the Office of Refugee Resettlement. You spoke about the credible fear and the well-founded fear of interviews in Guantanamo and in Cuba. But what about in the other countries, such as the African countries and the 64 countries that you mentioned where you do have a presence? How long, on an average, do those take from the time that they are put in a they arrive at some kind of refugee resettlement, or they arrive based with UN connections before they are actually located in either another country, a third country, or in the U.S.
Okay, I'll take a shot at those. In terms of the TRIG cases, I am not an expert at the TRIG cases outside the Refugee Resettlement Program, but I think I can give you an idea of why some of them take so long. As you may know, there is a relatively cumbersome statutory process. The definition of terrorism-related grounds is very, very broad. The process for an exemption requires the Secretary of State, the Secretary of DHS, and DOJ, Justice Department, to concur on exemptions. We have done that. I've lost track now maybe 15 different times there are exemptions. Many of them have been targeted to our refugee population, which is why we've been relatively successful using the TRIG exemption process. The challenge is there are many applicants, not just in refugee resettlement, but applying for green cards, adjustment of status, who are affiliated with groups that fall under the definition of a terrorist-related organization in the Immigration and Nationality Act. And that interagency process started with kind of the biggest groups and have been working its way through. So someone who is in the United States waiting that a TRIG exemption is technically possible under the statute, but the interagency hasn't gotten to that particular group yet. In most instances, that's the reason those cases are taking a very long time. There's a little bit of hope on the horizon in that the most recent TRIG exemption is something that we're calling the limited general exemption. And that is for individuals who came to the United States as refugees or approved for asylum. They're already here, and there's no derogatory information about their background. They can go ahead and be processed for their green card if they're otherwise eligible. And my understanding from my domestic colleagues is that they project that that could take care of 75% of the TRIG cases that have been sitting in the domestic pipeline. So knock on wood, that will turn out to be the case. I'm not 100% sure if I understood your second question, because you were talking about the Office of Refugee Resettlement. The Office of Refugee Resettlement, their responsibilities only kick in once a refugee is already in the United States. So if your question is, most cases come to the U.S. Resettlement Program either through a UNHCR referral or some individuals who can approach the U.S. directly. It varies tremendously in different countries and different programs what the average processing time is. I would say average from the time a case comes forward to a resettlement, average might be 8 to 15 months. Certainly there are Iraqi cases that have been pending much longer than that. There are Iraqi cases that we interviewed in 2008 who have not come to the United States yet, either because of an SAO issue or an IAC issue or something else. We can expedite cases, though. And so when either the U.S. government or UNHCR identifies some cases of individuals who are particularly vulnerable, often medical issues or protection issues, we can get cases through the system more quickly.
Thanks. Why don't we take two or three questions in a row, and then that'll be it.
Thank you. Mary Meg McCarthy from the National Immigrant Justice Center. As many of you may know, there was a dramatic increase in the number of unaccompanied immigrant children coming into the country in the springtime, late winter. And I was wondering if you saw any of those children through the Coast Guard in the high seas. My sense is that's not how they came in, but I was just curious. You mentioned that at times you saw minors, and I didn't know if you saw an increase. And then, Barbara, I just wondered if you've seen an increase in asylum applications as these children are able to apply affirmatively, even though they are in proceedings under the TVPRA.
Okay, and a couple more questions. Yeah.
Actually, my question was just a brief follow-up on the question about UACs and affirmative asylum applications. I just wanted to know if the Georgetown study, those statistics, are including minors or just adult applicants.
Okay, one more question.
Oh, I was just wondering if the interagency checks are part of the background checks used in processing I-130 cases, and if you've seen a slowdown in processing cases because of kind of the issues of the interagency checks in general.
Okay, so that's it. Any children coming in through the? You seeing any unaccompanied kids through the Coast Guard interceptions?
Yeah. Mine is the easiest question to answer as a group. We see very, very few unaccompanied minors, and have seen no increases whatsoever. It's very rare for us to get one at sea.
I really don't know the answer for affirmative asylum. I mean, I think certainly there's nothing on the scale of the changes that were happening on the southwest border that I understand from our colleagues at ORR. That's where the real increase was that they were dealing with.
And the IAC checks for the other types of cases?
The IAC checks right now are being used for refugees and for the refugee following to join. So for those of you who like form numbers, that's the I-730, or some people like to call them visas 92, 93. So when the P3 program begins again, the IACs will be part of the normal refugee vetting regime for priority 3 cases. At this point, the interagency check, the IAC, is not being used for other types of forms like the family-based or employment-based immigrant visas, the I-130s and I-140s.
And the question about our study in terms of minors, it includes minors, but only minors who would be involved in the affirmative application process. So there is a very small percentage of the 380,000 decisions.
Okay, I wanted to thank the panel. Thank Georgetown for hosting us again this year, and you've done a great job. Thank you.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.